the company went from being in the low 15% on the corporate equality index scale to being 100% in 2 years. It was a complete turnaround. It's really my, I would say, one of my biggest successes of all times.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today, Robin Leeds, is a senior political strategist, organizer, and advocate with more than 30 years of work in the government, labor, business, and nonprofit sectors. Her company is called Winning Strategies. In the Clinton White House, she worked on passing and implementing the National Voter Registration Act, and she's been in the middle of lots of stuff before and since. So it was very interesting to hear about her career path and current work. Robin is a good guest. You should listen. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Robin Leeds of Winning Strategies.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Robin, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Robin Leeds. I live in Washington, D.C. I've been here since 1993 when I moved to D.C. to work for President Clinton to implement the National Voter Registration Act. That was the second bill that President Clinton signed into law, and I was very involved in getting to the passage of that bill. I'm working on it since 1984, in fact. I moved here to work on the implementation and never left.
Well, where did you grow up?
I grew up in northern New Jersey, about 40 minutes from the city.
What kind of family?
What kind of family? A small nuclear family. My parents, my brother, and the dog. I grew up in a Reformed Jewish family. I did not grow up in a politically active family or a progressive family. I just grew up in a, I would say, more moderate to conservative Democrats. So I basically grew up in opposition to that. I became a young radical when I was in high school.
Why did you become a young radical and how did that manifest itself?
I became an activist in high school, mainly as a result of just being very concerned about the war and concerned about the future of civil and human rights and also women's liberation. So when I was a junior in high school, living so close to New York, I literally, with a ragtag group of women, girls at that point, we would go into New York City literally every weekend and go to a rally or a demonstration and go to the precursor to Our Bodies Ourselves, which was the New York Women's Health Center, and learn about women's sexuality, about women's empowerment, and just got very mobilized in that context. And so I was influenced in large part by my best friend and her family, who were part of the left for a long time. As a result of that, I was found by two teachers in high school who essentially rescued me because I was not your ordinary student. And one of them was the head of the teachers union in New Jersey, and one of them was an anti-apartheid activist, and her husband actually worked at the South African embassy. And so they both created independent studies for me in my senior year. And one was with the Committee for a Free South Africa, and the other was around access to women's reproductive rights and rape crisis and early domestic violence, sexual violence issues. I mean, this is like in 1975. So
around that time, the book Our Bodies Ourselves showed up. My parents just left it around the house, knowing that we as kids would read it, material there that we ought to know. And then I left a way huger volume of that for my daughters.
Yes.
Much more recently.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
That was a revolutionary book. I was involved in the original sort of early pre-Our Bodies Ourselves collective movement, running around with speculums and teaching young women about their female sexual anatomy and the value of masturbation and the myth of the vaginal orgasm. And so let's just say.
Let's just say that you were doing a service to some people back there.
I was trying.
It sounds like that adoption by two teachers giving you independent study was a really lucky break for you. How do you feel like that shaped you? It's obviously part of this development of you as an activist.
Yeah. Number one, I felt seen. I felt heard. I felt validated. There must have been like three or four of us that were in this category in my high school. They really rescued us, giving us a voice and making it possible for us to excel. And that was a very unusual thing at the time. They luckily got us. There were, I think, three of us were in this category. And they acknowledged and praised the activism. And so instead of being discouraged and thrown out or invalidated or threatened or whatever, they really lifted me up and they set me on my path. There's no question. And they encouraged me to create my own opinion, my own ideology, my own point of view, and to express it, which really was the fundamental beginning of my point of view, which has evolved over the years. But I have always, when I mentor young women, I always encourage them to have a point of view and to express that point of view and have that point of view kind of carry them through various challenges in their lives. Because a lot of people don't know what they think.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I do. Some things. How did your formal education continue?
I went to Kirkland College, which is now Hamilton College in upstate New York. I don't know if you know Hamilton, you might.
I'm aware of it, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Kirkland was sort of billed as a feminist college. So I really wanted to go there. I almost went to University of Wisconsin at Madison with all of my other activist friends, but decided to go to this, quote, feminist college. And it really wasn't a feminist college. So I spent a lot of time organizing rallies and demonstrations and hitchhiking to Colgate University to participate in a variety of activities. I managed my way through sort of again on the independent study route, but I was mainly an organizer and an activist and an advocate wherever I am. You know, it doesn't matter what campus it is.
Yeah. And you picked up other degrees or programs along the way after that, right?
Yes. Yeah. I had the wonderful opportunity, because I lived in Boston for 26 years, I was very engaged and involved in the Kennedy School at the Institute of Politics and on the Women's Leadership Forum and the Women in Public Policy program. And so I ended up being on the Harvard Women's Leadership Board for, I think, 6 or 8 years, working with the Women in Public Policy program there, and then became a fellow at the Center for Public Leadership, also at the Kennedy School, and had numerous opportunities through women's studies programs at various universities. So I was at AU for a while in the Women in Politics program. It's a little bit of a different path, but have been very steeped in academia from the standpoint, really, of my areas of expertise, whether it's in election law or democracy building or civil and human rights, whatever it is, finding a perch in many progressive academic institutions.
How did you enter the workforce after college?
I decided that I wanted to be a woman in a non-traditional job. I decided to try and get into an emergency medical technician program in Boston, which was mainly dominated by men. So I was one of the first 15 women certified as an emergency medical technician in Massachusetts, and then decided to work with a collective of people who wanted to start a nonprofit ambulance company to serve underserved communities in Boston. So we were able to get a massive grant from Catholic Charities, and we launched Project Place Ambulance, which was a not-for-profit ambulance company. And I worked as an emergency medical technician and as a public policy advocate as well on healthcare reform. I decided to become a union organizer, and I worked in numerous hospitals organizing unions for 1199 and Service Employees International and AFSCME, really taking on the private sector hospitals. That is the direction I went in. I went in a very progressive kind of union organizer, activist direction in my career.
Everyone I know who's worked organizing for a union early in their life found that very formative. Sounds like that's true for you as well.
I mean, it was extremely formative. I mean, number one, I got incredibly well-trained. I learned how to be part of a movement. I learned how to take on management by organizing low-wage workers, which were mostly women and people of color stuck in minimum wage jobs in the private sector hospitals. It definitely shaped me in terms of, a lot of my friends call me a border crosser because I can kind of move in and out of different sectors, and I can work with management, I can work with labor, I can work with in multicultural settings. I learned that very early on. I can work with people from different classes.
Did you feel antagonistic to the management side, or did you understand their point of view but support the minimum wage workers? How did you think of that battle?
In the early days it was very antagonistic. Well, particularly because the private sector hospitals writ large nationwide were very, very aggressive and still are union busters. They did work with two very sophisticated law firms out of Chicago that specialize in union busting. And so basically management tried to squash the union, squash the organizers. They tried to bust everything. So it was very antagonistic. I mean, it was strikes, was rallies and demonstrations. It was walkout. I mean, there was no discussion back in the day. As I moved through my career and my work, I was able to figure out how to move out of that more antagonistic dynamic into more of a common ground agenda dynamic. And I've done a lot of mediation, negotiations, bridge building, even with the building trades in the 90s, representing them in their political campaigns. And to the extent that they had ballot questions where they needed women and people of color and LGBTQ voters, there was an opportunity to force the building trades to make concessions to those voters. And so we were able to use that opportunity to negotiate some serious deals around access to training, access to jobs, access to long-term security in the building trades and to really break open the hiring halls. It had to be negotiated. Everything became a negotiation. So I would say that all of that really shaped my ability to do what I've been doing now for over 20 years, which is conflict resolution and crisis communications.
That makes sense. You mentioned coming to DC to work on motor voter implementation and passage, but also saying that that's been something you've been working on since 84. How did you get into that particular line? And tell me the story a little bit of
That. So it's kind of a fun story for me. So two of my mentors were Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward. I don't know if you know them.
I do. Having read some of their works on poverty. Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
Other guests on the show have often mentioned their mentorship along the way.
Yeah, yes. They were amazing. I mean, Francis is still alive. She's in her 90s. She's amazing. Richard died a while back, but they started an organization growing out of the welfare rights movement called HumanServe, which was Human Service Employees Registration and Voter Education Campaign. It's a mouthful. The whole concept of HumanServe, which was to register the unregistered through public human service agencies, and to fully integrate voter registration, nonpartisan voter registration, voter education, and voter mobilization into unemployment offices, into WIC, into food stamps, into AFDC, et cetera, because recipients of public benefits are largely not only women and people of color or single moms or whatever, but are also chronically disenfranchised when it comes to voting. So the question became, you know, how do we engage folks? How can we meet them where they are? And how can we use government workers to engage people at the point of collecting benefits? This was a Piven and Cloward construct. It was the kernel for Motor Voter. I call it the NVRA, but it's also called Motor Voter. So it was very exciting because it was the second bill that Clinton signed into law. Literally, that was 1993. I guess he signed it. Yep. I had been working on this issue for so long. I worked for the Committee on Election Laws at the Massachusetts State House. I ran the voter registration by mail campaign, which was a big ballot question initiative. Very passionate about voting rights and democracy. So once that got passed, I said to myself, I want to go and implement this thing. We all know how hard it is to implement a law. So it was a little bit of a pipe dream, but I went on a mission. I've been on every presidential campaign since McGovern. So I had a lot of relationships in the White House and just politically. And I made a very, you know, strong proposal and I built allies around it. And eventually I convinced the head of cabinet affairs to launch a pilot project. I mean, I wanted to do it fully government-wide, but I could not get the full embrace. So they agreed to do a pilot project through Food and Nutrition Services at USDA in WIC food stamps and AFDC. And that became my project. Because it was an unfunded mandate, it was very challenging. We got some stuff accomplished, but we didn't have the full support of the administration, which continues to be a problem even today, that sadly, as much as I loved all our presidents, it's been a missed opportunity. We have a federal law that mandates voter engagement through public agencies. And we're not utilizing it. I've been on this campaign. I mean, people see me coming. They're like, oh no, here she comes. She's going to want to talk about NVRA implementation.
And when I talk to people who are in the voter registration space, they say it's only doing 10 to 20% of what needs to be done. I don't think they've typically characterize that as a problem of the government, more of a problem of the law. But it sounds to me like you're much more on top of what happened there in terms of implementation. And maybe that ought to be something that gets pushed a little harder, especially where we're lagging in registration in that kind of community right now.
Absolutely. And that's why literally I have not given up this fight. I've had very recent conversations with folks at the White House about this. It's a gold mine. It's sitting right in front of us. And yet it's not being implemented. I mean, it's very minimal and it takes executive action. We can do anything by executive order. Cabinet affairs can launch any initiative they want. The closer we get to the election, because this has to be a 365-day-a-year.
The closer you get there, the more backlash you get about it, maybe?
There's more backlash, but there's more resistance from like White House counsel saying, Robin, this is too political. And I'm like, well, the longer we wait, the more political it becomes. And so literally every 4 years when we have a Democratic president, I'm on it because I want it to happen when it's not politically charged.
That makes all kinds of sense. So I know that part of your work is with Democracy Partners. And I had talked to Ken Grossinger.
Oh, he's a good friend.
He's one of the people who mentioned Piven and Cloward, I believe.
That's when we met.
I was wondering that. I was going to ask about that. So how did you connect with him originally?
I connected with Ken because he was an organizer for HumanServe. So was I. So we were in national meetings with Piven and Cloward building strategy around this.
It sounds like you've also overlapped in the sort of art and activism.
Well, that, yes.
Yeah, more lately.
Yes, which is a space that I absolutely adore.
Was that the first time in the federal government? Besides that, what did you think about operating within the government versus working as an activist on the outside?
I worked in the federal government for 7 years when the implementation of Motor Voter became super challenging. I got recruited to go over to the White House Women's Office, where I ended up staying for quite some time working on every issue related to the empowerment of women and girls that I care about. We got a lot done. We were extremely effective. My job was primarily dealing with all of the outside influencers and advocates on a variety of issues that they wanted to see more action on. I was really the door between the outside and the inside. And that is a very good role for me because I have all the relationships and the credibility externally, but I was also at the table internally. And so I could create situations where advocates could have a real voice at the table and sort of use their influence to move the internal agenda in the White House and throughout government. I landed there. I served until the last day when Gore conceded. I thought I was going to leave after the Monica Lewinsky situation. And we were actually asked if we wanted to leave or we wanted to stay. And it was a very hard decision because I was working in the women's office. And as you can see, I'm an old-time feminist. And I decided, because we had launched so many substantive initiatives that were moving, they were moving through the pipeline, they were announced and being implemented or about to be announced. And I just decided, you know what, I'm not ready to abandon this work. I've invested too much. And it was challenging. I mean, because a lot of our allies were not happy that I was staying or that numerous other people were staying. So
it was a huge scandal, but it also feels pretty small after the dust cloud that follows Mr. Trump around.
Exactly. It really seems quite small.
Quaint. What's the story with you and Winning Strategies?
So Winning Strategies is my firm. It was actually formed in Boston. Before I moved here, I had Winning Strategies and I did a lot of my work through Winning Strategies as a consultant. And of course, when I went to work for the federal government, I put winning strategies on the back burner. And then when we lost in 2000, I brought winning strategies back so that I could have a vehicle to continue to do my work. And so I've had winning strategies really since 2000. And I've had a variety of strategic partnerships, one with a large global firm at the time was called Burson Marsteller. And I worked with their crisis communications team for quite some time. And now I'm a partner with Democracy Partners. Winning Strategies is a partner with...
And Winning Strategies is basically you, or are there employees also?
Yeah, I have one employee, and depending on the project, I bring in various team members that I have a relationship with, and that's really worked well because it makes me more nimble. I can grow and I can shrink depending on the project, and Democracy Partners is really good for that, and so was Burson Marsteller, because I had access to very seasoned people who had a very broad skill set that I could bring a team together pretty quickly.
It seems a little unusual to be a strategic partner of that size to these firms rather than go over there fully and become a partner in those firms. What was the advantage of that to you, and how well has that worked?
Yeah, the advantage is that I had more autonomy. I could basically decide who I wanted to work with and who I didn't want to work with, and sort of try to maintain my basic values in terms of who I worked for and what I did. And in a lot of these large firms, that doesn't fly. So embedding myself with more independence gave me the opportunity to decide what I wanted to do, who I wanted to work for, and how I wanted to conduct my work. So it was ideal in that sense.
Did you end up finding some of your work yourself directly and bringing in some through those bigger entities? How did that work out?
Yeah, I would bring business in and I would be brought into existing business or part of a pitch team. The unique thing about my work at Burson was that I brought a set of skills and relationships and subject matter expertise that didn't really exist in the firm. And so I would be kind of the resident go-to for any disenfranchised constituency you could think of that typically most of our clients would alienate and would have to repair relationships with. So whether it was pre-litigation, litigation, post-litigation, bad press, workplace challenges, sexual harassment, Me Too, whatever it was.
Tell me the story of your involvement with Barilla and their scandal. Yeah.
Pasta company. Yeah. Yeah. So Guido Barilla was set up on Italian radio by a conservative host, totally unprepared and also just not very forward thinking himself about his vision of the family. And his vision of the family was very heterosexist. The minute it hit the radio, there was a viral movement starting in the LGBTQ community attacking him. One of the most organized communities in the country, when they get pissed, they act. So the business came in through Burson Marsteller, and it was basically, you know, a major piece of business. And there really wasn't a lot of depth of knowledge.
It was kind of a crisis management piece because people were starting to boycott that kind of pasta, right?
Yes, we got involved before the boycott, but the boycott took off and it was a global boycott. It was really taking hold. It was not just bad reputation, but it was also losing market share. You know, it was impressive from an organizing standpoint. So it came in through our CEO and it was brought to the crisis team. And because it had to do with the LGBTQ community, they're like, where's Robin? Because they knew I had all those relationships. I got brought on the team and I ended up being really the lead on the work. And it was probably one of the best experiences I had in crisis because I was able to build an incredible relationship with the senior Barilla team and with Guido himself. And I took them immediately to the Human Rights Campaign Corporate Equality Index program. And we got them centrally involved in a global listening campaign. And we set up meetings with all the key leaders in the community. And I took them all around and taught them how to listen. And they did. They actually listened and they learned and they changed their mind. And the company went from being in the low 15% on the corporate equality index scale to being 100% in 2 years. It was a complete turnaround. Everything from launching a huge DEI program to setting up an external board with incredible people on it, most of whom I knew and I recruited, to setting up workplace programs and developing leadership among the all levels of staff. It's really interesting because one of the people I recruited is a man named David Mixner, who was a leader.
Didn't he just die?
He died 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And so I've been on the phone with all the Barilla people because I recruited him to be on our DEI board. I mean, it was just a major turnaround. And it's really I would say, one of my biggest successes of all times.
There's a lot of corporations who have made various degrees of modification internally in response, sometimes to pressure like from the outside and sometimes for other reasons. I almost feel like our moment right now is characterized a little bit more by backlash to that.
That's right.
Tell me how you see what's going on right now in the relationship between the pressure coming from outside and corporations in terms of how they're acting politically.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's giving corporations a pass.
It's giving them a chance to not act responsibly.
I mean, there was a period when corporate social responsibility was highly valued after lots of struggle. And there was a time when everyone was doing DEI, you know, DEIB, all this stuff. And we made a lot of headway, but it was not stable enough to sustain in the face of all of the attacks from the right. And so I think at this point, it's kind of let a lot of corporations off the hook because there's no sense of accountability and there's no real commitment. There are exceptional corporations that will sustain it and are really leaders in the CSR space, and it goes deep, but it is not the majority of corporations.
When you think about the world of corporate America right now, in a time when our politics is very hazardous from multiple directions for them, honestly. Do you think they're going to hide during this big election coming up in general? Or do you think?
Oh, no, they're not hiding. It's a graduated picture. But, you know, obviously, most corporations have lobbyists. Most corporations have PACs. Most corporations have deep pockets. They're trying to work both sides against the middle. They're not beholden to anyone. And now with President Biden, I think gave an incredible State of the Union. I'm so happy about it. There's been a resurgence of engagement, which is such a relief. But he's very strong on narrowing the wealth divide, on closing the wealth divide, on closing the gender wealth divide, on closing the racial wealth divide, on holding corporations accountable to equity and to paying their fair share, not to mention dealing with workplace conditions and wages and childcare and things that corporations as a group are not, I mean, this is a gross generalization, but has never been a profit center. I mean, some of the tech companies kind of get it because they want people to come to work and they want to them to stay at work. So they've made some concessions, but this is what we're dealing with. It's really a class warfare.
I think that President Biden's been quite a good president. And in some fronts, I'm quite puzzled by the lack of credit he's getting. I have had conversations with young family members and read the polls of some leakage of support in minority communities. Some of this is Gaza related. Some of this is his age and perceived energy on things that they care about, or just the disconnect sometimes between young and old. But I'm curious how you view the relationship between communities that you've had a long time organizing with and supporting, and the current president during this campaign with all that's at stake.
You mean in terms of where the progressive communities are?
Yeah. And in terms of what it's going to take to bring people back that are at this moment fractured away?
It's a tough one. I've been in the middle of some very, very challenging conversations with people I consider allies and colleagues and friends. A lot of it blew up around October 7th and the just basic conflict between Netanyahu and Hamas and the impact on Gaza and some really tough decisions that the president made and the time that it's taking to actually get to a real ceasefire and to advocate for a two-state solution. I don't know if you heard Schumer's remarks.
I definitely did, yes.
Yeah, I mean, they were remarkable. And I think it's definitely influenced the direction that the administration is taking in terms of making this ceasefire real and advocating for a two-state solution. And my hope is that the Democratic forces in Gaza and in Israel will really challenge the current leadership. And so we can move a democratic platform. Now, will that happen? Who knows?
And in time, yeah.
Yeah, but it is, as you said, it had a major impact on some very important constituencies. And then I think there people just have a problem with old. I have an issue with that. I think being old is a great thing. And I think being old and being accomplished and being out there and kicking butt is amazing. And we have to turn that conversation around.
And I think there's a lack of understanding about how much this is a team sport, not just two individuals, one against each other, but the difference in direction for the country between the Trump team and the Biden team, all the way up and down the ballot. It's about as big a gap as I can imagine in any election in 100 years. How do you see the threat right now from the Trumpist right?
Well, interestingly, I listened to your podcast interview with, and I'm forgetting her name, who worked at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Heidi Bayrick?
Heidi, yeah. Yes. I listened to that, and it's a lot of things that I already knew, but it was very, very, very poignant, powerful, and frightening, terrifying, and real, and very well documented. And I don't think we're getting that message out.
You know, Ruth Ben-Ghiat also, I talked to her, if you're aware, she has this book out about the playbook that authoritarians run, looking from Mussolini forward. I think to a lot of people who are not paying a lot of attention, they're not steeped in it, they don't realize just how much our system could potentially be changed by the aspirations on the right.
Well, exactly. The question is, how are we getting that message out? And how are we controlling the dialogue around the future of our democracy? That's not necessarily just a campaign thing. I mean, that's also the entire progressive movement, the entire pro-democracy community. I mean, we have a responsibility. We have got to get up every morning and make these points really clear. Unfortunately, I know people who are really just, I wouldn't say apathetic, but wiped out. and are not carrying the message forward in the way it needs to be carried forward. The president and his team, the administration, has accomplished so much that is so substantial and so like real time impacting real people. And yet the message is not getting to the people we need it to get to. So why?
Well, there's an awful lot of people trying to carry the opposite message as part of it. And also, I think there's always been a challenge in a broad coalition that internal disagreements can be what we pay attention to rather than the big combat with the other side. And I think that's as acute now as it is in some other cycles.
Oh, no question. Yeah. For example, I come out of a Black Jewish alliance paradigm. That's like the whole Freedom Summer, Martin Luther King, Rabbi Heschel, that whole construct. I think our generation grew up there of activists. And what I see happening in that alliance right now is very troubling. And I have been, since October 7th, doing everything I can to consolidate that alliance, having difficult conversations, but trying to move the ball forward in terms of acknowledging the foundation, the positive foundation, where we were, where we are, and where we have to go. Because if that alliance is broken, I'm concerned about the outcome of the election.
I think that's one of them. And there are plenty that are going to need active repair, which is unfortunate when all the incoming is going on.
That's right.
But I think that all of us have to take our own individual responsibility too. You can't say, I wish the Democratic Party would do something different, which I hear a lot.
All the time.
It drives me a little bit crazy. I think that it's not a spectator sport, this democracy, and that's people exactly need to stand up for what they believe in and not waste this time.
And also, if you have a problem, come to the table and solve it. But standing on the sidelines and saying, you Democrats, that's not a solution. It's not an answer. I hear it all the time. And I'm constantly saying, it's not the Democrats. It's we Democrats. Change your language.
Or our coalition against Trump. I don't care if you call yourself a Democrat or not, as long as you...
Yeah, you're exactly right. Hopefully, I mean, I think that the State of the Union...
One step forward.
Is a one step forward. And we have to build on that momentum and do everything we can. And just quickly back to your point about having to spend so much time repairing relationships that really should not be broken is a major setback for us. And it's a very heavy lift. And that is really my role right now with the campaign is repairing relationships. I'm the Tikkun Olam in-house resident or something. I don't know.
Well, I hope there's other people working with you because it seems like it needs to be fully populated with skilled people. And of course, everybody makes up their own decisions on this. No one does what you say because you say it. They have to bring themselves to the table in a certain way.
When I hear people in my world saying, I'm not voting for Biden, I'm having a really hard time with that.
I am too. I'm hopeful that some of those people will come around. What worries me is if we lose this election by a small number of votes in a small number of states, the people that didn't participate, that ought to be with us, are going to see a whole lot of damage to everything they believe in that is going to be on a monumental scale. The protest makes no sense in a policy or political way.
People get into this whole frame, and this is, I think, a problem of the left, of the lesser of the two evils kind of arguments. That's not the paradigm right now, I'm sorry. And I will not accept it. And I push back as much as I possibly can without trying not to alienate people, but it is really challenging times.
And we got
friend.
A lot of third party candidates that can sort of they're just going to sop up people who can't find themselves with Biden. When you put them into the polls, it looks worse for him.
Right. I mean, we've got Kennedy has got to get out, period.
He's not going to. I don't think. I don't think Jill Stein is. I don't think, you know,
Cornel West.
From what I understand, and we alluded to it earlier, you also have a passion in the arts and politics space. You want to say a word or two about what you're up to there?
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually an incredibly beautiful space to be working in. I was appointed to the President's Advisory Commission on the Arts. When I started that work, I didn't want to just check the box. I wanted to have impact. And so my strategy was to link up with our Vice President of Social Impact at the Kennedy Center, amazing human, Mark Bamuti Joseph, very, very talented artist, but also a social activist, and doing amazing programming that needs to be lifted up. But I really was intent on establishing a social impact endowment fund for this work in perpetuity. That has been my mission really for the last, you know, a little bit over a year. You know, it was working through the pipeline. I mean, the Kennedy Center is a government entity, largely quasi public, and just bringing all my skills of building a concept, building a coalition, and working it through the pipeline internally have really paid off. The fund was announced recently, right before the honors, and we're looking at our first very large foundation grant going to be resolved shortly. And so I'm very excited about that. And we started the first ever social impact task force, and we're working with the creative community to advance some of the most important issues of our time. Art and culture does bring people together. It's a language that we can all communicate with in a way that I've never seen before.
You've spent a lot of years in different parts of the progressive ecosystem. If there were something that you could wave your magic wand and change about how we organize together, what would it be?
It would be learning how to find a common agenda. And even if we didn't agree on everything, that we would have a baseline of agreement and we would be unified in our actions to move that agenda forward, rather than being completely purist on every single issue and sitting at a table not agreeing.
There are some mechanisms for doing that. What do you think are the best institutions or mechanisms that help us unify in that way?
Well, it's interesting because sometimes the foundation sector can play a very positive role. Let's just take the pro-choice community, for example, the reproductive justice community. Everyone's knocking on the door, the same doors for money. We're reinventing, we're duplicating, we're repeating over and over again, same old ways, same old mistakes. And some of the foundations have gotten together and said, look, you're all doing great stuff, but you're not coordinated, you're not unified. Come to this table. Let's figure out who's doing what. Let's stop duplicating. Let's stop reinventing. Let's have a division of labor. And then let's fund you. And sadly, sometimes that's the best vehicle. I know Democracy Alliance does that as well. There are numerous organizations that actually have resources that people want, or collections of donors, individual progressive donors. Because everything is ragtag. It's like take a number and stand in line. And history repeats itself. And having been in this space for so long, I think the most frustrating thing is this lack of cohesion, lack of unity, lack of common agenda, and what I call the diva syndrome, which is that everybody has to have their own organization. You know, every personality has to have their own organization. That's not working.
I'm working on, for my 1,000th episode, taking questions from guests, and I have received a whole bunch of them. And one of them was, if we had to design an institution for helping figure out which of our many flowers should bloom and which should be culled or grouped or however you want to think about it, what would that be? And so I was thinking about how to answer that, because I do think that some of the groups that you talk about, funding groups, are part of that. And part of that also is just the buyers of any service. And there are some things about duplication that are helpful because nobody gets it right. It's very hard top down to choose winners successfully. But do you think there's a missing institution there or institutions, or what might you propose if you had that opportunity?
So at one point, and I was very involved in this, was the Rainbow Coalition. It was a Jesse Jackson construct. It was also a Mel King construct from Boston who ran for mayor, who was my mentor. It basically took the point of view that we have to work at the intersection of race, class, gender, religion, whatever, but that we needed a rainbow coalition with a common agenda that cut across intersectionally all of these different constituencies and be a united front. The rainbow's not so strong right now. The Poor People's Campaign, Reverend Barber, I think has some potential in terms of his orientation around the intersection of class, race, and gender, which I think is very helpful, very productive. Those kinds of organizations either need to be strengthened or reinvented, because we spend a lot of time fighting with each other about who's more oppressed. And I find that totally unproductive and debilitating. And we're still doing it. We're doing it right now around Israel and Gaza. We're, you know, there's conversations around what was worse, slavery or the Holocaust. I don't want to have that conversation, but it's being had. And it's the tried and true divide and conquer that we're just fueling for the new, for the right.
If Trump and his very deceitful route back to power isn't enough to unite us, What is?
Yeah, I mean, in the face of fascism, what? So that is the most mind-boggling thing for me right now. I've actually been at tables where people are comparing slavery to the Holocaust. Seriously.
Both of those are horrific, horrific things.
It's appalling.
Yeah.
It's just appalling.
Yeah.
But these are the conversations, well, and these are smart people.
Stop it, people.
And yeah, so I'm constantly being challenged, like which battle am I going to fight? Who am I going to take on? You know, should I retreat? Should I move forward? I mean, it's stuff that we all deal with, but it's frightening.
If you were talking to a young person kind of like you were in college, and they wanted to know where they should locate themselves, maybe for the rest of this campaign, what advice would you give them?
If they want to do partisan or nonpartisan, I would ask first. And on the nonpartisan side, I would spend a lot of time in the voting rights movement. That's where I always go, whether it's voter registration, voter education, voter mobilization, voter protection, election protection efforts, which are vast. And we've done a really good job on election protection. And you can do it on the partisan side or you can do it on the nonpartisan side, whatever makes you more comfortable. And then in terms of the campaign, you know, if you're a public policy person, you care about a particular issue, get involved in that at that policy table. If you are a grassroots organizer, go to one of the key states and get on the ground and work with the local activists. Get involved in the party. I mean, join the platform committee, join the rules committee, go to the convention. There's so many things that could be done. Granted, sometimes it's not easy to break in and find a place, and that can be discouraging.
It's a very permeable politics that we have, and there's a place on some smaller organization or some local campaign for everybody that has skills.
I agree. I mean, just get active. Just jump in.
Part-time or full-time, one or the other.
whatever it is. Or, you know, if you can afford it, volunteer. And that's a whole nother discussion about where the money is going, but because I'm busy raising it.
Do you feel optimistic or pessimistic at this moment?
I feel optimistic. I feel that I have to be optimistic because if I'm not optimistic, it will stop me in my tracks. And we can't afford that.
Well, it's really fun to talk to you. Is there a question I should have asked you that I failed to?
No, I think you were incredibly comprehensive and you covered a lot of bases.
Well, it's interesting to me. Anything else you want to say?
Just thank you for the work you're doing. I think your podcast is great. I didn't even know about it. I also want to thank one of my assistants who is an audio journalist, Kylie Miller, and she really hooked me up with you, and that was a great thing.
Yes, I guess I ran into her on a previous interview with Judy Heumann. Yes,
yeah.
Who is just an amazing human.
Yes, she was one of my closest friends. She lived down the hall from me.
Wait, you live at Kennedy Warren?
Yes, I do.
Yes, because I've taken a walk with her out of that, or she rolled and I walked, but
of course.
Yes.
That's where I live.
Ah, I got it. I'm not too far up. I'm up in Chevy Chase, DC. So,
well, let's definitely stay in touch. I'm excited to meet you.
Okay. Thank you. That was Robin Leeds. She is at winningstrategies.us. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.